Hello and welcome to the 19th episode of Nations of Charlemagne, French Absolutism. Today we are going to be delving into 17th century French history, focusing in particular on the reigns of Louis XIII and Louis XIV, and how the aspects of our previous conversations on the 30 Years' War and indeed the French Wars of Religion are going to permeate through this discussion, and how we're going to see the fashioning of a new type of political order. But before I sort of delve into the chronology, I thought a good way to introduce this topic was by looking at one of the most ardent defenders of French absolutism, who was very much familiar with Louis XIV, Bossuet, who is going to be one of the subjects for our discussion on Monday. He was the court preacher to Louis XIV. He was the Bishop of Meaux, and he was tutor to Louis le Grand Dauphin, the eldest son of Louis XIV, albeit he never became king. And Bossuet was a strong advocate of political absolutism and the divine right of kings. And I thought it'd be interesting to look at his own definition of absolutism. So this is from the political formula from the very words of scripture, which is in the description if you want to read it. And his first article for the characteristics of monarchy go as follows. First, royal authority is sacred. Second, it is paternal. Thirdly, it is absolute. Fourthly, it is subject to reason. All of this must be established in order in the following articles. Royal authority is absolute. In order to make this term absolute odious and insupportable, many writers pretend to confuse absolute government and arbitrary government, but nothing is more distinct, as I shall make clear when we speak of justice. The prince need account to no one for what he ordains. Observe the mouth of the king and the commandments of the oath of God. Be not hasty to depart from his face, and do not continue in an evil work, for he will do all that pleaseth him. And his word is full of power, neither can any man say to him, why dost thou so? He that keepeth the commandment shall find no evil. Without this absolute authority, he can neither do good nor suppress evil. His power must be such that no one can hope to escape him. And, in fine, the sole defence of individuals against the public power must be their innocence. The doctrine is in conformity with the saying of St. Paul, wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good. Nonetheless, kings are not free from law. When he is made king, he shall not multiply horses to himself. He shall not have many wives that may allure his mind, nor immense sums of silver and gold. But after he is raised to the throne of his kingdom, he shall copy out to himself the Deuteronomy of this law in a volume, taking the copy of the priests of the Levitical tribe. And he shall have it with him, and shall read it all the days of his life, and he may learn to fear the Lord his God, and keep his words and ceremonies. Let his heart not be lifted up with pride over his brethren, nor decline to the right or to the left, that he and his sons may reign a long time. It must be remarked that this law corresponds not only religion, but also the law of the kingdoms, to which the prince is subject, as much as anyone else, or rather than the others, through the righteousness, droiture, of his will. This is what princes find painful to hear. What prince can you show me, says St. Ambrose, who believes that which is not good is not permitted, who holds himself obligated by his own laws, who believes that power should not permit itself what is forbidden by justice? For power does not destroy the obligations of justice. On the contrary, it is by observing what justice prescribes that power avoids crime. And the king is not freed from the laws, but if he sins, he destroys the laws by his example. He adds, can he who judges others escape his own judgment? And should he do that which he condemns? Hence that fine law of a Roman emperor. It is a saying worthy of the majesty of the prince to recognize oneself as subject to the law. Thus kings are subject, like the others, to the equity of the laws, both because they must be just, and because they owe to the people the example of justice-keeping. But they are not subject to the penalties of the laws, or as theology puts it, they are subject to laws, not with respect to coercive power, but with respect to directive power. this aspect of the king ultimately being confined by a constitution or indeed by his solemn oath to God is something we're going to try and examine in terms of understanding the system of absolutism, because in many senses, absolutism is, of course, a misnomer if one was to associate it with despotism. Nevertheless, there is an aspect of despotism, a little hint of fragility into the system, which I think can help explain why, when we enter into the Ancien Régime period, even though I hate to use that term, in the 18th century, the French political system was so unprepared and incapable of dealing with the threat of the French revolutionaries. But before we get onto that, I just want to tie this back into the lecture regarding the French Wars of Religion. So, of course, in 1598, we have the Edict of Nantes. We have the first Bourbon king in Henry IV, who begins as a Huguenot, a French Calvinist, and converts to Catholicism. Paris is worth the mass, he famously said. And it seemed that many aspects of his reign were very positive. He was a much beloved king, albeit there were many assassination attempts by Catholics who believed that he was a crypto-Protestant still. And he still very much pursued an anti-Spanish foreign policy, an anti-Habsburg foreign policy, albeit this is less an account of his, again, potential crypto-Protestantism, rather than the fact that this is the foreign policy which has been pursued by all French kings, definitely since about Charles VIII. So Henry IV is killed in Paris in 1610 by a Catholic fanatic, François Ravaillac, and Louis XIII ascends to the throne, and I believe he's about nine when he ascends to the throne. So he immediately is in a very similar situation. I mean, what is remarkable about the situation about Louis XIII is that it bears all the hallmarks of the preceding period we've gone into, in that you have a minority reign, so you have a young king, as it was with Catherine de Medici. We're talking about the reigns of Francis II, the reigns of Charles IX, the reigns of Henry III. The two first kings in particular were very young when they inherited, and Catherine de Medici essentially ran the French government until the later stages of Henry III. So it looks, for all intents and purposes, that France has now reverted back to the system. A popular and competent king is gone, to be replaced, like Henry II, to be replaced by his young son, Louis XIII, and again under a Medici regency. Now, so for the first 7 years of his reign, so from 1610 until 1617, Louis XIII is, again, governed but essentially by his mother. And I just wanted, I has had this quote here, which is an observation by the English ambassador to France in 1619 regarding, again, the most unlikely proponent of French absolutism in the form of the young King Louis XIII. I presented the King Louis a letter of correspondence from King James, my master. The King Louis assured me of a reciprocal affection to the King James, my master, and of my particular welcome to his court. His words were never many, so being so extreme, a stutterer, that he would sometimes hold his tongue out of his mouth a good while before he could speak, so much as one word, he had beside a double row of teeth, and was observed seldom or never to spit, or blow his nose, or to sweat much, though he was very laborious and most indefatigable in his exercises of hunting and hawking, of which he was much addicted. Mary, his regent, pursued a moderate policy conforming with the Edict of Nantes, following in the characteristics of Catherine de Medici. She was not, however, able to again see a rebellion, again launched by a Prince d'Usang, Henry Prince de Condé, very much echoing the earlier situation with the French Wars of Religion. In this case, she was also supported, Henry Prince de Condé was supported by Gaston, Duc d'Orléans, who would again repeatedly come up in opposition to his brother and his nephew. And at this time, there's also this lingering issue over the issue of French succession, because the Bourbon dynasty has only recently been established. Louis XIII is the second king. The House of Condé, which is a cadet branch of the House of Bourbon, had, but both Gaston and Louis died young, because of course in those days it was very rare for all children to mature to their majority. then Henri de Condé would have had a claim on the throne. And of course, as Prince Toussaint, he expected to have an active role in the regency of Mary de' Medici, as again, we're looking at the same problems with the French Wars of Religion. In order to solve these grievances, we see the last ever summoning of the Estates General before the French Revolution in 1614. Of course, the Estates General won't be summoned again until 1789. And this Estates General essentially achieves nothing other than the fact that, there is some minor reference to the papacy and simony, etc. But there are no lasting resolutions. If anything, one of the only effects of the Estates General was to usher in the, you know, the preeminence of Cardinal Richelieu. He won't be a dominant force in French politics as of yet, but this is where he really comes to the fore and becomes noticed. Beginning after this, in 1615, Mary de' Medici becomes increasingly reliant on an Italian, Concino Concini, her favourite, and he becomes immediately incredibly unpopular. And he antagonises the Prince Toussaint, Condé, and we already mentioned this aspect of this friction between the Queen Mother, the Queen Regent, and the Prince Toussaint as to who should rule the government during the Prince's minority. And this also, as we've seen before, corresponds with another Huguenot rebellion. So it is the House of Condé combined with the Huguenots lead a rebellion in 1616 and 1617. And after, again, as is often the case with these wars of religion, there is a brief truce and then conflict ensues yet again. After this, there's a remarkable situation where Concini is rather dramatically assassinated. Again, this was very expected based on his extreme lack of popularity and the fact that he held his role a foreigner, simply again due to his being the fact that he is the favourite of the Queen Mother. So Concini is killed, and Louis XIII decides to appoint his own favourite, his own minister, who is at the moment the Grand Falconer of France, Charles d'Albert. And in order to do this, he needs to very dramatically send his mother into exile in order to actually gain control of the government. And d'Albert immediately makes himself very popular by, again, the usual charge of selling offices to political friends. And what's more interesting is that Mary de' Medici, kind of like we see with Catherine de' Medici in the later reign of Henry III, begins to actively oppose the reign of her son, wants to come in and exert some form of new political influence. And there is a rebellion in 1620 around the person of Mary de' Medici when she escapes her confinement in Blois. And again, this is where one Cardinal Richelieu, now Bishop of Luçon, moves in and becomes a mediator between mother and son. After this, d'Albret is appointed Constable of France, after which he and Louis set out to quell yet another Huguenot rebellion. And it's during this rebellion that d'Albret is killed at the siege of the Huguenot fortress of Montauban. Following the death of d'Albret, Louis is determined now that he should rule by council. His mother returned from exile in 1622 and entered said council. And Condé recommended violent suppression of the Huguenots, so now he has been reconciled back into the back into the royal fold, and the king is deferring to his mother, the former regent, and de Condé as Prince Toussaint. However, again, this is very reminiscent of the sort of war we see during the French Wars of Religion. There are a series of key fortresses held by the Huguenots. These are the Place de Sûreté, the places of surety or security, which had been confirmed by Henry IV during the Edict of Nantes. In this case, we have the fortress of Montauban, of Montpellier, and La Rochelle, most famously. Because the Huguenots are walled up in these fortresses, and because the royal forces are unable to take these fortresses from the Huguenots, they essentially have a permanent power base with which to sally forth and conspire with noble rebellions going in France, which dominate the early reign of Louis XIII. So, in summary, the early reign of Louis XIII before 1624 is very unstable, and it looks like it's going to follow the similar pattern of the previous 50 years. Indeed, when we have the Treaty of Montpellier, which ends this initial Huguenot uprising in 1622, it more or less confirms this status quo. And of course, this all has changed by the arrival of one Cardinal Richelieu, or l'Eminence Rouge, the Red Eminence, as the unlikely savior of the French monarchy in light of the legacy of the French Wars of Religion. And again, this is really to emphasize that the French Wars of Religion really never ended. Rather, this is a continuation, and we're going to see various key events during the 17th century which call into, a complete conclusion all of the facets of the French Wars of Religion that we saw in the previous century, whether it be the religious uprising or whether it be the aristocratic revolution, such as, the importance of understanding French absolutism as a reaction to the legacy of the French Wars of Religion. So, in going back briefly to Cardinal Richelieu, he was a member of minor nobility, born Armand du Plessis. His father, Seigneur de Richelieu, died in the Wars of Religion, almost leaving his family bankrupt, were it not for, again, his loyalty to Henry III, allowing the family, the du Plessis family, to appropriate the revenues from the bishopric of Luçon. And this was a common practice at that time. Often it was expected that one member of a family would hold the rank of a bishop, a bishopric, and it would essentially be held as some sort of dynastic fief. It's very difficult because, again, bishoprics, especially in the Holy Roman Empire vis-a-vis France, controlled vast estates, vast revenues. So there's always this conflict between the aristocratic families who want to control those revenues and, of course, the local clergy who want to invest that money back into the spiritual practices of the church. Armand would have risen up the ranks of the French army were it not for the reluctance of his elder brother Alphonse to confirm the family's control over the bishopric of Luçon by becoming bishop. Thus, Armand was encouraged to take his brother's place and join the clergy, and he became bishop in 1606 at the age of 21, where he then became a very fervent practitioner and reformer within the church. Implementing the provisions of the Council of Trent, becoming one of the strongest advocates in France of papal authority and the privileges of the clergy, and a stalwart opponent of Gallicanism in France, which is all the more significant when you see the total sort of sum of Louis XIV's religious policy with the Edict of the Clergy and the revocation of the Edict of Fontainebleau. After the dissolution of the 1614 Estates General, Richelieu, now known to the king, entered the service of Anne of Austria, spouse to Louis XIII, and then became an advisor to Mary de' Medici, and in 1616, foreign minister. He was briefly disgraced with the fall of the regent when she was exiled by her son in 1617, only to be restored to the royal council by negotiating the accord between Queen Mother and the king. With the death of D'Albret, Richelieu was promoted to cardinal on the king's nomination and successfully removed his rival de la Ville, Vieuville in 1624, becoming the head of the government. In 1625, he intervenes, and again, this is relaying this back to the previous lecture on the 30 Years' War, because, of course, I intentionally left out quite a lot of France's involvement in that and wanted to keep it very much focused on German politics, obviously, because this is a series which goes into depth with regards to French history, with regards to Italian history, with regards to German history. So bringing this back to the French reasons for the intervention. Of course, the French had already intervened. They'd already tried to intercede when Ferdinand II reasserted his control as, King of Bohemia in 1618. Then you have the climactic Battle of the White Mountain, and Ferdinand II imposes strict Catholic rule, and there's a vast exodus of the Bohemian nobility. By 1625, it looks like things are going very well for the Catholic side, the imperial side. And relaying this back to how this directly affects French interests. Right from the moment that he assumes control of the government from 1624 onwards, Richelieu adopts a position which is pro-French, very French nationalistic, at the expense of, Catholicism as a whole. So he rather than supporting Ferdinand II. And this is again a major source of conflict between him and the king, because the king was very pious, and he therefore believed, you know, he had to be forced into this position of advocating for French national interests at the expense of Catholicism as a whole. And it's rather remarkable to consider that Richelieu enters into political prominence in France by being a stalwart defender of the Tridentine reforms and a promoter of papal infallibility and papal influence over the clergy. And now he has again now risen from the ranks, become an inseparable facet to the French court. Now he is chief minister. He has adopted a exclusively pro-French political position, and it's very easy to see that all of his political machinations are coinciding with this idea of French national security and French power vis-a-vis the Habsburgs, who are still in the 1620s the dominant force. It should be mentioned, looking back, that when we looked at the late the you know the early reign of Henry IV, Spain at one point looked as if they were going to put a queen, a Spanish queen, on the throne of France, and France was essentially going to become a puppet state of Philip II. Of course, this doesn't happen. Henry IV becomes king, he converts to Catholicism, and the House of Bourbon resumes the old foreign policy of the Valois of Henry II of Francis I, intervenes in the Holy Roman Empire, intervenes in the Netherlands, and does incredibly well. And this also has the effect of not only shoring up Catholic support by the fact he converted, but bringing many of his Huguenot supporters on board with the campaign against Spain, and ensuring French sovereignty and the power of the French dynasty, in this case the House of Bourbon. Of course, Cardinal Richelieu takes a very different stance to the Huguenots compared to Henry IV. And again, this is lesser, you can consider from his religious point of view, but because the Huguenots are now being supported by the Spanish, such is the weakness of the Spanish position. No longer are they have the powerful Catholic League with the members of the House of Guise. The House of Guise is still around, but it is much diminished. Much of the power of the League has been sapped away by the fact that the Bourbons have sincerely converted to Catholicism, and they are leading the charge against the Huguenots now in France. So, relaying this back to how we understand Richelieu's intervention in the Thirty Years' War, much of this relates to the idea of the Spanish Road, the fact that there are certain ways connecting northern Italy, Lombardy, also, the papacy and the kingdoms of Sicily and Naples, going through Switzerland or going through Savoy or going through Austria, to connect the Spanish Habsburg armies with the Spanish Netherlands, and by extension linking them to the Holy Roman Empire. By 1625, the Bavarians and the Habsburgs have taken control of the Palatinate, so it seems that their control over the road is supreme, and so the Spanish begin intervening in an area of Switzerland called the Valtellina. It's an area sort of roughly sort of the area sort of bordering Switzerland and Italy. And this is when Richelieu begins to take an explicitly pro-Protestant stance against the Spanish, the Catholic Spanish, for the sake of maintaining French national interest in preventing the free flow of Spanish soldiers from Germany and Italy, and therefore perhaps conspiring in a coalition against France. But these military interventions are rather rare at the beginning. So for the first fight, for the first 10 years of his foreign ministry and his stance as Prime Minister of France, Richelieu instead intervenes in the war indirectly, first by financing the Danish intervention, and then by financing and becoming more allied with the Swedish in 1631, who inflict major defeats such as Breitenfeld and Lützen on the imperial forces. Nevertheless, up until now, the French haven't intervened in the 30 Years' War directly. In 1626, so relaying this back to his internal reforms in France, now we have a semblance of what the international situation looks like. He takes Cardinal Richelieu takes the rather unprecedented position of abolishing the office of Constable of France. This is an ancient office which is established in 1060, What is fascinating about this office is that it became essential during the time of the French Wars of Religion, when you had a king in his minority, because when you had the regency of a queen such as Catherine de' Medici or Mary de' Medici, it was a necessity to have a constable of France such as d'Albret, so that the king had a major military commander with which to act in his interests. But the cardinal abolishes said rank for the explicit purpose that no man should be conferred that much authority other than the king. So the idea is to centralize all military initiative back into the hands of the king. The idea being to take away the independent spirit of the French aristocracy and the French military, and for them to become far more subordinate to the king. And having a figure like a constable of France, who is essentially a chef d'armée, chief of the army, to be that opposition figure potentially to the king, is the principal reason why Cardinal Richelieu was so prepared to abolish that ancient office. Moreover, in terms of this campaign against the power of the nobility, the cardinal began demolishing any sort of fortified residence in France which served no function in terms of the actual defense of the realm. So these would be the residences of very powerful nobles in the French interior. And of course, this policy inevitably brings him into conflict with the Huguenots, because this goes against the whole notion of the Huguenots having their own power bases guaranteed by the king in the form of the Place de Sûreté. And this alarms the Huguenots so much that this precipitates a foreign intervention by both the Spanish and the French. Sorry, the Spanish and the English, rather. Charles I, Charles I becomes King of England in 1625, deliberately intervenes on the side of the Huguenots, albeit it goes very badly. And Richelieu, even though, as I mentioned so often, the French army has been essentially, unable to deal with the situation of these great fortresses, Richelieu is persistent. He besieges La Rochelle from 1627 and 28, and even though it takes a year to starve out the Huguenots, he finally takes the key fortress of the Huguenot movement. There's a brief rebellion that follows, and it's crushed. And even though aspects of the Edict of Nantes will continue, such as toleration and the fact that the Huguenots are allowed to practice their religion in private, the Huguenots have now lost their independent power base of which they can sally forth and potentially destabilize the kingdom. And the king is very much convinced of this course of policy against the Huguenots, for the exact reason that the Huguenots have proved again and again that they can't be counted as loyal subjects. The purpose of the Edict of Nantes and Henry IV's new settlement when he became king and converted to Catholicism was the idea that it didn't matter what your religion was, obviously, if you're a Christian, so long as you were a faithful subject of the king. And this is why we see the early sort of incarnation of French absolutism in the 16th century is very much based on allegiance to the king rather than subservience to the Pope. But nevertheless, Cardinal Richelieu is abolishing that and trying to prove, and rather convincingly, that the Huguenots have proven to be consistently disloyal. And then, in order to prevent a return to the anarchy of the previous 50 years, the Huguenots had to lose the privileges afforded in the Edict of Nantes. In one last attempt to gain power, Mary de' Medici then turns against the cardinal in an event known as the Day of the Dupes. And of course, Cardinal Richelieu has quite an expansive spy network. There's a large aristocratic rebellion which focuses on the character of the Queen Mother, who still hasn't lost her desire to intervene in the affairs of France and sort of act as the great eminence of the kingdom. But the cardinal is aware of this. He's able to control the king, and he's able to definitively exile the Queen Mother. And after 1630, essentially Louis XIII is putty in the hands of Richelieu. He's essentially the potentate of France, even though, again, he is the stalwart defender of French absolutism. The king is expected to hand over all executive authority to Richelieu. And he continues in this vein, often brutally putting down aristocratic rebellions. So we have the rebellion of Henri de Montmorency, and he is executed. And then there is also criticism from the clergy. So when Urbain Grandier criticizes him in 1634, not only is he put in prison, he's then accused of witchcraft by Richelieu, and he is burnt at the stake for heresy and witchcraft. And all of this is augmented by the fact that Richelieu has now a vast, expansive spy network a la Walsingham in England. So by 1635, he has full control over the levers of power, and there isn't a strong nexus of aristocratic opposition within France to really oppose him. And again, this is based on the fact that Richelieu has the full confidence of the king. With the Peace of Prague, Richelieu now declares war on the empire in Spain. So obviously the Peace of Prague is the first sort of general peace within the Holy Roman Empire, which sort of ends the 30 Years' War. But of course, ending the war for this point for France would have meant that all of the interventions, all of the indirect sponsoring of campaigns against the emperor would have failed. So this continues, and France has to intervene directly in order to undermine and weaken the Spanish Habsburgs and the Austrian Habsburgs. And the French do rather badly at first. There aren't any definitive victories in this Franco-Swedish campaign against the Habsburgs until we get to Rocroi. And Richelieu would actually never see French victory against the Spanish or against the empire, because he's going to die in 1642. But while he was alive, he introduced wartime taxation for France, the gabelle and the taille, which fell on poorer members of the Third Estate. To ensure the efficient collection of taxation and the administration of policing and royal justice, the cardinal introduced the entendancy system, the system of entendant, a network of royal agents granted commissions and non-hereditary offices, crucially, chosen from members of the noblesse de robe. What a noblesse de robe is, it's a noble of the robe. It's essentially, if you can imagine, the closest modern analogy would be a life peer, someone who is brought in to the ranks of the nobility from the bourgeoisie, often because they have paid for political favors. So these are people who are looked down on by the traditional nobility of France, because they have bought their way into the high ranks of the French political system. But it means that their entire sort of role within the government and their nobility is dependent on the goodwill of the king. So these people are far more loyal, and they don't have the relationships with the local provinces that the ancient aristocracy have. Meaning that they are, again, far easier to control, and they're not going to be in a position to really launch any aristocratic rebellions against the king. So they could be useful agents of the king. And this is really, bypassing feudalism and feudal lords, and instead relying on the system of direct emissaries of the king. A system of royal provinces had been introduced some 100 years four under the reign of Francis I, but until now this lacked a system of administrators really to govern these provinces. When looking at the system of the entendant, this of course wasn't invented by Richelieu. There were commissioners appointed by the king, often with limited terms, to oversee very specific functions or provinces. But what Richelieu does is he makes this into a permanent system, a permanent institution by 1635, corresponding with the French declaration of war on Spain. And when he encounters peasant rebellions who are mainly resentful of the cost of war, which has now been put on them, and having to pay the taille, the land tax, he brutally crushes peasant rebellions in 1636 and 1639. Despite many attempts to depose him, the cardinal died in office and was succeeded by Mazarin, an Italian cardinal, who had offered his services to Richelieu and become his deputy in 1640. Mazarin was keen to cultivate relations with the queen, said this Anne of Austria, often sending her gifts, which was fortunate for him, as Louis XIII would die in 1643, only a couple of months, I believe 5 months, after Richelieu died. And the new king, Louis XIV, was only 5 when he became king in 1643. Thus, Anne of Austria became regent, and Mazarin continued on as chief minister. And this is a lot of sort of contrivance as to why Anne of Austria was so reliant on Mazarin. One is that there was a conspiracy right at the end to depose Richelieu, which by proxy was seen as treason against the king. And Anne of Austria, again, seeking her position, trying to secure her position in the end, because she had been explicitly told in the will of Louis XIII that she was not to become regent. So Mazarin knew of this conspiracy, knew that she hadn't informed her husband of a plot against Richelieu. And so Mazarin had a huge amount of political leverage. And so when she, you know, she was left in the position where there was no obvious regent, there was now the situation of, you know, is it going to be the king's brother, or now the uncle, you know, Gaston d'Orléans, who's going to be the regent, or is it going to be the queen? Well, conveniently enough, Gaston d'Orléans is exposed as part of this betrayal, so he doesn't become regent, and Anne of Austria and Mazarin are able to convince the Paris Parlement, essentially the French equivalent of the Senate, albeit is again mainly there for ratifying the laws of the king, to back Anne of Austria to become regent, and she rules over France with Mazarin for the next 18 years. Mazarin, in the interim, uses this opportunity to remove various rivals, such as de Noyers and de Chavigny, and help secure Anne of Austria's regency again throughout this period. Despite the difference in character, Richelieu was considered a very sort of domineering character, and Mazarin was seen as far more diplomatic. And despite the fact that I don't think Richelieu ever considered that Mazarin would follow him as his successor, Mazarin did follow Richelieu in prosecuting the war with the Habsburgs. And under the French generals Condé and Turenne, the French gained numerous great victories, such as Rocroi and Laon. By 1648, France had annexed parts of Alsace, and with the subsequent League of the Rhine against the Habsburgs, France had demarcated a sphere of influence on the left bank of the Rhine, which will become the focus of Louis XIV's foreign policy. In 1659, the French made peace with Spain, and this is based on the fact that Catalonia, because Spain had been fighting almost endless wars, in 1643, I believe, Catalonia revolted when Louis XIV became King of France and declared, because Catalonia had been part of the Carolingian Empire, i.e. the Empire of Charlemagne, that Catalonia could divert, you know, switch its allegiance away from the Spanish to the French. And it was a massive headache for both empires, but in the end, the Spanish were able to take control over Catalonia, and in compensation for that, the French were able to gain Roussillon, which is the most southeasterly possession of the French. Though victorious against the Habsburgs, and this is after the Peace of Westphalia, so this is 1648, there are two treaties, one in 1648 dealing with the Austrian Habsburgs and one in 1659 dealing with the Spanish Habsburgs, Mazarin now had to deal with the discontent which was born from the war. Mazarin made the mistake of alienating both the populations of Paris and the court nobility, levying tax for access to the court. And there was a special tax that he levied, which was, again, dating back to Henry IV, the idea that homes could not be built beyond the city limits of Paris. So he retroactively decided that anyone who had built a home outside the city limits of Paris suddenly had to pay a vast tax for the privilege of doing so. And this infuriated the Paris Parlement so much that the Paris Parlement essentially summoned itself. It evaded an order by Anne of Austria to be prorogued, i.e. To be dissolved. And it made the unprecedented demand of insisting on the right of habeas corpus, the Latin principle that one can't be detained without a just cause, and also the right to approve taxes. And this is happening in 1648. So just look at this and remember that across the Channel, 1 year later, Charles I is going to be executed by Parliament. So at the same time, we are entering into France's own equivalent of this conflict between Parlement and the monarchy. Here, Anne of Austria attempts to arrest members of the Parlement, and she does this, she tries to be clever, she times this to coincide with the victory celebrations at Notre-Dame de Paris after the French victory of Laon against the Austrians. Many members of the Parlement are in the Notre-Dame de Paris. She bars the doors and she arrests them. However, all this does is force the Parisians and, of course, Gaston d'Orléans, the Prince du Sang, the uncle of the king, to rise up in rebellion against the regency. And this rebellion is called the Fronde. And what a Fronde is, it's a slingshot. During the rebellion in Paris, the Parisians would use these little slingshots and again hurl rocks at the Royal Guards, and it the term the Fronde comes from these slingshots. Now Mazarin acts to this very quickly, believing essentially he now needs to bring all the force of the French army to bear on this revolt. This speeds up the process of the Peace of Westphalia, which has already been negotiated over the last sort of 2 years. Mazarin brings de Condé, who has already won the Battle of Rocroi, back to besiege the city of Paris. And then Mazarin attempts to play on the Parlement's fears of the Parisian mob to allow themselves to distance themselves from the mob. They're not going to be held, essentially ransomed by the mob, with the idea that there will be some form of parliamentary reform. When Mazarin learned that Parlement members were still plotting, and moreover they convinced Condé to join them, Mazarin definitely had the conspirators, including Condé, arrested. And the consistent theme, as even though Le Condé, being a Prince d'Usang, being one of the highest members of the aristocracy in France, and being a very capable military commander, he is constantly being outmaneuvered by his political adversaries. He is politically inept. But it gets worse than this. Even though it appears that the revolt in Paris has, for the moment, been quelled, the rebellion has now moved beyond Paris into a general revolt against, taxes and the system of intendants. And of course, this is also flaring up in regions which have a large Huguenot population. So in the Languedoc region, the Béarn region in the south. After Condé managed to escape, he began to lead the rebellion and lead its armies, but he was defeated by the other great French war captain, Turenne. The Parlement had been unable to assert its authority, and the nobility led by de Condé had failed to remove Anne or Mazarin. Royal authority was thus confirmed, and the rebels become essentially blended in with the conflict with between France and Spain, with many, such as the Condé, essentially becoming sort of semi-partisans with the Spanish until 1659. But even then, many of these captains, including de Condé, would eventually return to obedience and become willing servants of Louis XIV. This was the last great general revolt of the aristocracy in French history, and this is what I mean by this period demarcating the end of various trends we saw with the French Wars of Religion, the combining of the Huguenot rebellions and aristocratic rebellions to impose some form of regency or regime or liberate the king from his evil counselors. This has sort of been ended with La Rochelle, and it's now ended with the Fronde. The government victory in the Fronde did not resolve the kingdom's financial crisis, however, and Mazarin was forced to appoint one of the wealthiest men in Europe, Nicolas Fouquet, as Minister of Finance, who lent vast sums to the crown. The government had effectively become dependent on the goodwill of a group of select financiers. And Fouquet was only removed from office by Colbert when it became apparent that Fouquet was misusing state funds. We've discussed the practical means from 1625 to 1661 by which the French government became more absolutist, and now we're going to consider the soft power angle before returning to the reign of Louis XIV and examine how his reign would expand upon the reforms ushered in under the two cardinals. And I have here an article by Ranum, which is in the description if you want to read it. And this, first of all, goes into the idea of sacred power or soft power in the form of courtesy codes, and this is going to lead us into the power of Versailles. Courtesy codes, sustained by absolutist ideology, provided the state's first line of offense against French society after about 1630. Individuals and corporations of various ranks and wealth suddenly found themselves charged with being insolent, impolite, and slanderous by royal officials. Still worse, royal officials humiliated them by declining to perform the established courtesies toward them. Nobles, judges, and town councillors in particular found themselves slighted by representatives of the king on all matters of political power and ceremonial. In the 19th centuries, historiographies about the rise of the modern state, as in the largely functionist sociology of the 20th century, those dramatic confrontations between between king and subjects, entendants and local elites, and other royal officials, often have been dismissed as ridiculous or explained into insignificance as mere signs of deeper social conflicts. In hastening on to historicize the 19th century bureaucratic state, historians scarcely ever asked if there was ever a mode of verbal action developed by the Crown that anticipated or preceded the establishment of bureaucratic functions. Did the courtesies of the Intendant so disorientate, humiliate, enrage, and eventually overwhelm the local elites that finally a centralized bureaucratic administration could be established at the expense of local autonomy and personal authority? The power of local elites and of their individual members depended on their ability to inspire society, to pay them the proper respect. Parliaments, governors, and local nobles and town councillors found nothing but humiliation and reduced authority when they failed to gain satisfaction after an Intendant's affront. A snub might carry the holder of a charge to heights of power by enhancing his reputation, even as it had brought low some other officer or body of officials in the body politic. Courtesy was the very lifeblood of the society, as Richelieu knew all too well when he repeatedly exhorted Louis XIII not to suffer any indignity or disobedience from his subjects. The first element in the encounter of those who personified the state with society was the regard, the gaze, which royal officials gave towards others standing before them. No courtier, no matter how intimate with Louis XIII, ever dared to address him without properly lowering the eyes, reverence, and a salutation of Sire, or the more recent Votre Majesté. Similarly, no titled nobleman, high or low, prelate, town councillor, or whatever, could fail to pay the proper respect to the monarch. Indeed, their titles, offices, and even names had been granted to them by the king and the state. In written encounters, no letter or other instrument of the state could be composed and sealed without the proper salutation to subjects, and similarly, no letter could be written to any individual or institution representing the sovereign authority without beginning and ending with the proper marks of respect. Above manners and infinitely more complex were those honnêtes, due individuals and corporations according to their rank. Anton de Courtine, the author of the most frequently republished courtesy book in the 17th century, describes all these as a science, a field of knowledge. Indeed, it was, for the marks of respect due up and down the social hierarchy were very subtle and complex, as well as rationally derived from an overall conception of what society was. Learning this science was a central feature of humanist education in the entire early modern period. The rustic would always bow lower than he should for the rank of the person encountered, or fail to take off his hat at the appropriate time, or take it off when he should have kept it on. In Yves Casta's reconstruction of the honnêtes of the 18th century Languedoc, we see extended to the society at large a code of behaviour built up slowly over the preceding centuries that assured social stability and a sense of individual self-esteem. Castan's effort to discover why there was such a high percentage of law cases over slander led him to his reconstruction of the honnêtes. The escalation of a feud over a tiny bit of land often led to the use of abusive language by the parties in conflict, and even litigation might be the only form of redress available to the party suffering verbal abuse. To breach the code of honnêtes was an act of hostility, and it was the king, his council, and the law courts that alone could provide an ultimate redress. In other words, the king's power to decide what was or was not a breach of honnêtes between all his subjects gave him enormous coercive power upon society in all its constituted elements. But what if the party giving offence was the king himself or one of his officials? There was no appeal beyond the king, and when a royal servant was accused of humiliating some individual, there simply was no recourse outside the state. The great noble, whom the king had defined as discourteous, had little alternative but to go into exile. No matter how high the marks of respect might be for the princes of the blood or of the church, they could never claim to arbitrate between breaches of the honnêtes in which the king or one of his officials was involved. There are numerous examples of conflicts which arose from alleged abusive behaviour all the way up and down the social hierarchy. These were the results of day-to-day jostling of powerful families and corporations on nearly the same rungs of the social ladder. In all these more overt confrontations over honnêtes, however, it is scarcely possible to see the rise of the modern state. The medieval state gave the kings all authority and institutions needed to resolve these conflicts between subjects. What happened to the honnêtes in periods of civil war and social unrest? tested and retested within society in periods of tension, conflicts soon inevitably to have led to the increased appeals to royal authority over society. Civil war and social unrest thus laid the foundations not only for the absolute state, but for the greatly enhanced coercive power of the modern state over society. What was novel after 1630, however, was the systematic use of courtesy as a device to coerce all the king's subjects to an enhanced obedience. Previous efforts had been sporadic and confused about whether the marks of respect due to the king and his officials were to be granted to the royal person or to the state. Under Richelieu, there was a program used by the crown to remove this ambiguity inherited from the Middle Ages, particularly over the boundaries between chivalry and monarchy. The third and most coercive level of interaction, courtesy, consisted of enforced genuflections, hat doffing, reverential tone in speech, lowered eyes, obeisance, an assurance of obedience, as well as a willingness to render service by all subjects. Perhaps the most important of all the arms of courtesy at the king's disposal was his decision to accept or decline a salutation from a subject, or whether he would permit that subject to speak to him. Earlier kings had been accessible. Louis XIII, and still more his son, maximized their power over others by declining to receive subjects or to speak with them. The denial of the king's presence, of his gaze, and of the possibility of speaking greatly enhanced the power of those officials who spoke in the king's name. If the prince failed to see you when you felt yourself to be in his presence, a feeling of being snubbed or wounded resulted. When the king stopped to engage a single individual in conversation in the sea of courtiers surrounding him wherever he went, that person felt especially honoured and eager to serve the crown. The variations of this pattern of behaviour would occupy Saint-Simon in volume after volume of his memoir. If a letter lacked a proper salutation, the sender might never receive a reply from the king or his secretaries. With Louis and Richelieu acting together on the assumption that courtesy was a weapon to enhance royal authority, it is not surprising to find jurists echoing their programme within a legal perspective. A discourtesy towards the king, according to Cardin Lebret, constituted grounds for trial and sentencing for lèse-majesté, i.e. insulting the majesty of the king. William Farchurch brilliantly sums up the implications of Lebret's doctrine of lèse-majesté as found in De la sovereignté du roi, and the sovereignty of the king, published in 1632. The first definition that Lebret gives of treason is of slander, a speech act expressing disrespect for the king in his person or authority. Indeed, Lebret went further. A slanderous remark was not only punishable as such, because sovereign princes were vicars of God, his living images, or rather gods on earth, as Holy Scripture calls them, their person should be respected by us as divine and sacred things, so that one may say that when one insults the king, one insults God himself. Now, Christian Jouhard expands this article, The Perfection of the King, and this notion of royal power or Baroque soft power. And again, this article is linked in the description. On the 10th of November 1633 in Bordeaux, the Archbishop Henri de Sourdis and the governor of the province, the old Duc d'Epernon, insulted each other publicly and even came to blows. This local scandal quickly took on the dimensions of a national scandal. The Archbishop seemed to possess none of the visible, tangible assets of his adversary: wealth, authority, troops, the support of the local nobility, a central role in the socio-political hierarchy of the province and the city, numerous endorsements by the local clergy, etc. Yet he would carry off the victory in a spectacular manner. The old Duke was exiled and excommunicated. He lost a significant share of his power. Through the intermediary Sourdis, it was Richelieu, or if one prefers, power, which made him fall. The manner in which the trap functioned allows us to see at once in this action the organization of the power of the state. The state power is in fact divided into two powers: a consecrated power, which arbitrates and condemns the king, and an absent power, with no institutional existence, which acts the minister, a recognizable duality. But more importantly, it is here that for once we recognize the association functions. The royal perfection guarantees to the acting force its freedom of action. In return, the acting force gives the perfection the opportunity to manifest itself as such. Practical separation of roles forms part of the mystery of the state and its secrets. This division of powers helped make the person of the king perfect, the perfect incarnation of a function, the apparent centre of a system, a process which had been at work since the religious uprisings and the victory of Henry IV. But the representatives of the king, provincial governors, for example, received no direct benefit from this evolution. As custodians of a party delegated with public authority, they were also, in the French system, living images of the monarch, without, however, having at their disposal the symbolic means of assuring their functions as reflections of a perfection. They found themselves to be prisoners of values and of discourse. Whatever their actions, they would never represent more than the pale reflection of those values and this discourse, whose presence and grandeur they were nonetheless required to manifest, provoked by enacting force. Epinon invoked the person of the king, whom he represented, in order to protect himself, but by this act, and the scandal that they brought on him, and which his adversaries propagated through the press, he showed that he was in contradiction with the royal perfection, which he was supposed to reflect. The perfection condemned him. Juon then goes on to explain that much of the success of Richelieu is owed to this cultivation of the perfect reflection of royal power in the form of himself as the chef d'état, as the chief minister of state, which in turn augments French royal absolutism. And the example given is the construction of the Château de Richelieu, a model city with an ornamental moat and pleasure gardens, which you can see on the left here. Now, how does this relate to the most famous expression of French indirect power, or this undisclosed power, the soft power of Versailles? Louis was declared of age to rule in 1651, but only with the death of Mazarin some 10 years later did Louis decide to assume personal role and dispense with the services of a chief minister. Up to this moment, I had been pleased to entrust the government of my affairs to the late cardinal. It is now time that I govern them myself. To you, my secretaries of state will assist me with your counsels when I ask for them. I request an order you to seal no orders except by my command. I order you not to sign anything, not even a passport, without my command, to render account to me personally each day, and to favour no one. Versailles had been his father's hunting lodge, though Louis had stayed there briefly during an outbreak of smallpox in Paris. Louis's early years had been plagued by the rebellion of the Fronde in Paris. Establishing a power base outside of Paris, therefore, had a practical utility. In the same year of his assumption of personal rule, Louis visited the Château de Caux-le-Vicomte, the residence of Nicolas Fouquet, designed by Louis Laveau, and the gardens by Charles Brun. The château was in the style of the Château de Richelieu. It was both an aesthetic pleasure for Louis and a political epiphany. The combination of artistic outward perfection, soft power with hard power, for Fouquet imitating Richelieu, was now one of the most powerful men in France. With the help of Colbert, Fouquet was removed, and then Colbert was charged with directing the construction of Versailles. The idea, therefore, of the king's personal rule at Versailles were from the outset inextricably linked. From 1668 to 71, the old hunting lodge was enveloped by a new Italianate palace. After Laveau's death, d'Orbais was charged in 1670 with the construction of a model city of Versailles to be the new centre of government and court. Although construction progressed slowly under Mansart, the Hall of Mirrors was finally built, and then accommodation for the council, servants, and other nobles. By 1682, the court had moved to Versailles. Louis XIV had established a de facto capital of France outside of Paris. More than that, the prestige associated with proximity to the King of Versailles and the deliberate display of the grandeur of the ballet. Of course, the King would often perform many of the leading roles himself. Opera and the king's patronage of theatre, the works of Moliere and La Fontaine, he encouraged an ability to voluntarily quit their estates and join his court in Versailles, even though at first this decision was incredibly controversial, because it was a terrible location, and virtually the nobility who were most eager to join him at first were essentially living in a swamp. But nevertheless, as we see throughout the process of his reign for about 50 years, from 1661 until 1715, Versailles is always in a state of constant construction. But by 1715, there is something resembling the grand palace that you can see today. Nonetheless, nobles paid a great price for becoming resident in Versailles. The king was not generous to his nobles. To receive pensions and even gain access to Louis, the nobility was forced to wait on the king to receive notice, let alone favour, expanding upon the necessity of courtesy to ensure the king's absolutism. Meanwhile, the nobility were closely watched. Louis had achieved dominance by turning his life into theatre. Symbolically, Louis XIV was le roi soleil, the centre of the universe and peerless, and a cult of personality was cultivated for Louis outside of Versailles through his patronage of portraiture. He commissioned some 300 portraits of himself, and often in these portraits, the king was displayed in some sort of Greek fashion as the god of the sun, Apollo, riding the sun chariot across the sky. And in every single repose, he was majestic and virile. Albeit this wasn't always the image that the French subjects had of him. Some still had this conception of the old medieval monarch. Others, even less, had a much darker conception of him based on his constant wars and the human cost in building Versailles. While the ancient nobility waited on the king, Louis continued the practice of elevating the noblesse de robe, i.e. The upper bourgeoisie who had essentially bought into the ranks and nobility like life peers, to commissions, believing that the nouveau riche, former bourgeoisie, would essentially owe everything to the king. They would lack the legitimacy to rise up against his authority, as with the high nobility during the Fronde. Thus, the intendancy system had now effectively supplanted French feudalism. The role of Versailles was not simply to project power to the nobility and inculcate a state of dependency, but to project French power throughout Europe, indeed the world. By the beginning of the 18th century, France had overtaken Italy as the cultural centre of Europe. French became the court and diplomatic language in Europe, replacing Latin, a process facilitated by the regulation of the French language through the Académie Française. And even though we still see various dialects in France at this time, we have now set this idea of a Parisian dialect, confirmed by the Académie Française, which of course had been instrumented by Richelieu some 40 years earlier, to essentially establish the definitive aspect of diplomatic French. Versailles would have imitators from the Bourbon kings of Spain to Naples to the Dukes of Bavaria. Now, moving on from Versailles to the Wars of Conquest and essentially the actual implications of this absolutist system that we have now from 1661 under Louis XIV. From 1661, France reaches relative apogee under Louis XIV, though his reign held serious portents of decline, which we later see in the long road to the French Revolution. Continuing the policies of the cardinals, the king waged wars continuously throughout his reign as part of the ongoing struggle against the Habsburgs in Spain and Austria until the Spanish War of Succession. In 1667 to 68, the king used his marriage to the Spanish Mary Theresa as a pretext to prosecute the so-called War of Devolution, during which the key cities in the Spanish Netherlands, such as Lille and Tournai, were ceded to France. In 1672, Louis' aggression precipitated a diplomatic revolution in the United Provinces to oppose the French. Louis was determined to seize the Spanish Netherlands in its entirety, and he would need to defeat the Dutch first to enable his conquest. A coalition of the Habsburgs and the Dutch now opposed him, while the English entered into a half-hearted alliance with the French. And this again is Charles II, as part of the Restoration, is very much imitating the absolutism of Louis XIV, but it's all the more remarkable that the Dutch are now forced into this position where they are allying with the Spanish and the Habsburgs, their perennial enemies, against the French. And to my mind, this is foreshadowed with the Treaty of Maastricht, or was it the Treaty of Munster, which ended the 80 Years' War. The act which really precipitated the end of the 80 Years' War and convinced the Dutch to side and make a peace with the Spanish were the rumours going around that because Catalonia was controlled by France at that time, that the Spanish were prepared to give the French the Spanish Netherlands and in exchange for Catalonia. And that would, of course, meant that the main military land rival to the Dutch Republic would have come from France, not the Spanish. Louis possessed many advantages in commanders such as Condé and Turenne, various military reforms undertaken by Laveau, which enabled France to maintain a large professional army with speedy mobilization. In contrast to the rather haphazard mercenary conflicts of the 30 Years' War, Laveau is all the more significant in the fact he was able to successively subordinate the French aristocracy and incorporate them into this new army. That and the fact that the French army was absolutely huge. During the 9 Years' War and the War of Spanish Succession, we see the mobilization of hundreds of thousands of troops, before the levy en masse was introduced during the French Revolution. So what we're seeing here is the creation of a professional army with a centralized system of command, a modern system of logistics. And to add to that, from 1667, around the time of the War of Devolution, Louis was convinced of the necessity of building a series of effective fortifications on France's northern frontier. Because if you look at the geography of France, to the south you have the Pyrenees, to the east you have the Alps and the Rhine, but to the north there is no effective boundary against France, and this is where the growth and decline of France was, you know, most apparent. You can see it, most of these conquests are happening in this area in the northeast at the expense of the Spanish Netherlands. So the effect of the Vauban fortifications across the north essentially means that France is not invaded for the next 100 years, really up until the French Revolution, making this all the more remarkable. But of course, this adds to France's pressing financial concerns. But these are great projects, military reform. Again, these are really ushered in under Louis XIV, building on the precedents set by the two cardinals. By 1678, we have the Treaty of Nijmegen, in which the free county of Burgundy, known as the Franche-Comte, is finally ceded to France. This region, I believe, had been temporarily ceded to France during the Treaty of Senlis, during the collapse of Burgundy some 200 years prior to this. But this was the first time that France, the two halves of Burgundy, the free county of Burgundy and the duchy of Burgundy, had been united for the first time in 200 years. And of course, this pushes the French border to Switzerland and robs the Spanish of a crucial possession. And yes, Judge Caligula Bushman is saying the Peace of Munster in 1648 for the Dutch in the 8 Years' War. Not content with his conquests, Louis XIV established the Chambers of Reunion, a number of courts meant to fabricate claims on the left bank of the Rhine based on obscure medieval precedents to Luxembourg, the Saarland and Strasbourg, which he would take by force in the Wars of Reunions. And this, of course, you know, linking this back to earlier episodes in the Nations of Charlemagne. If you look, there were endless treaties regarding the various border alignments between the various Carolingian monarchs, whether it be Middle Francia, West Francia, East Francia. So based on that, there was some very ancient precedent, almost 1,000 years at this point, for the French possessing these territories. A facet of the French conquest up until this point is that they had a very sort of dubious legal basis to them. With the War of Devolution, it was simply a reprisal due to the Spanish not paying Mary Theresa's dowry. But as the French become more expansionist, again, we're talking the era pre-French Revolution. This isn't expansion conforming to some idea of natural boundaries. You have to have expansion based on, you know, inherited claims. And therefore, in order to legitimize his conquest, Louis XIV has to contrive this Chambers of Reunion to justify his expansion towards the left bank of the Rhine, and focusing on the two major cities of Strasbourg, in which again is surrounded by Alsace territory, and Cologne in the north, which will become, you know, the main source for French woes later on. In this war, and again, this is, I would say, the height of France's diplomatic power, because in the War of the Reunions, this is 1683-1684, France and the Ottomans are attacking the Holy Roman Empire from both sides. The Ottomans attack Vienna and are decisively defeated in 1683. So this is the height and the decline of the ancient Franco-Turkish alliance, which had been consecrated under Francis I. And again, the failure of the Ottomans to take Vienna, interestingly, has, you know, severe effects on the expansion of France. In 1684, France has really reached the zenith of its expansion. And over the next 20 years, France is going to be in a series of, you know, terminal wars in order to confirm the power it's already gained. Now, at the height of his power, Louis XIV begins to turn his attention to the Huguenots, still privileged by the Edict of Nantes. From 1681, he was now intent on securing religious unity and his own control of the church. This was a time where Louis was coming under the religious influence of Madame de Maintenon, his morganatic second wife. Already, Louis had prevented Protestants from obtaining high office, prevented Protestants from moving around in the kingdom and prevented intermarriage between Protestants and Catholics. But now he was formally adopting the position of a quius regio, ius religio, in that he wanted the elimination of the Huguenots on the basis that the ruler determines the religion of the country. As for the Huguenots, Louis used his main... Interestingly, we have the use of a large standing army during peacetime. So from 1681 onwards until 1684, the fact that France has been able to raise this massive army during wartime, Louis XIV maintains this army. And one of the effects of maintaining this army, not only does it mean that Louis XIV can pick off certain claims on the left bank of the Rhine, but this issues in the system called the Dragonnade, whereby certain French soldiers would be billeted explicitly into Huguenot homes. So French Catholic soldiers would be forced again, would be living in the homes of Huguenots in France. They wouldn't be allowed to move these Huguenots, and they would be forced to pay the costs for hosting these soldiers. And this was essentially an indirect means of coercion to force the Huguenots to convert, because once they converted, they would be immune from the system of enforceability. Otherwise, people tended to go into exile. In 1682, you have the Declaration of the Clergy in France, authored by Bossuet and the then Archbishop of Reims, Letellier. And this finally confirmed the various statutes of Gallicanism in law. And this act was the four articles, the so-called four articles, were read from pulpits throughout France. Gallicanism, of course, is this idea in France that established by Francis I, that the church in France is somehow higher or separate, has greater autonomy as the eldest daughter of the church compared to all other churches within Christendom, within Europe. To this end, the assumption is that even though the Pope is supreme when it comes to morals, the French king has the right to nominate bishops, which are then ratified by the Pope. But these articles of Gallicanism here are remarkable in that they explicitly declared the divine right of kings without a submission to a Pope, and therefore the king was absolute in his independence on matters temporal, while confirming this ancient conciliarist attitude, which he talked about extensively on this channel, of the Council of Constance back in 1414. And by this is a negation of an interpretation of papal infallibility, whereby a pope is only infallible when it is confirmed by the judgment of the whole church, i.e. the pope sitting in an ecumenical council. And for the advocates of Gallicanism, this is a form of political and episcopal Gallicanism, i.e. This is supporting the powers of the king and the authorities of local French bishops, the local church, vis-a-vis the powers of the Pope. Now, this leads to a 11-year break with the papacy, wherein the bishops appointed by Louis were prohibited from discharging spiritual functions until 1693, when Louis XIV formally retracted the articles in the letter to Innocent XII. While not formally enforced, the spirit of Gallicanism formed the overwhelming majority opinion of the French clergy for the next 100 years, until the issue will be raised again with the civil constitution of the clergy during the French Revolution. In 1685, we see the Edict of Fontainebleau, or the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. Protestant churches were to be demolished and private worship was to be ended. This had the desired effect of causing many leading Protestants to convert to Catholicism, though it has been argued that this seriously damaged France, and the fact that there was a massive loss of talent and emigration of up to 200,000, though Louis claimed that this was actually much higher, as many as 900,000. In my estimation, this decision was undertaken earnestly by Louis XIV, because it was now becoming increasingly obvious that Louis XIV had undergone a sincere religious conversion through his association with the Maintenon, in the extent of his own daily devotions and his strict observance of the liturgical calendar. But moreover, in terms of the political aspects of this, the Edict of Fontainebleau, I believe, was aimed to leverage the Pope's acceptance of the Declaration of the Clergy, i.e., yes, I can have the rights to appoint bishops, and I don't believe that you are supreme in matters spiritual. However, the caveat being that I'm a supreme defender of the Catholic Church. So yes, you have less authority over the Catholic Church, but France is to be more Catholic, even if you are to be less powerful within France. In the end, this proved futile, as France's fortunes changed dramatically for the worst over the following decade, and the negotiating position of the French obviously fell with it. a coalition had been building against France from the Wars of the Reunions, and the Ottomans were now being decisively defeated in the Great Turkish War. Despite the climate, Louis pushed his expansionist agenda into the Palatinate and hoped to secure the French bishop in Cologne, the vital city on the Rhine. Now, to my mind, this was twofold. Louis XIV wanted to gain access to these crucial choke points on the Rhine, and of course this was also pursued by Charles the Bold some couple of hundred years before, when he wanted to establish Kingdom of Burgundy. But control over Cologne and control over the Palatinate meant that Louis XIV was now in control of two of the seven electors. So it is possible that he wanted to be elected Holy Roman Emperor after Leopold von Habsburg would have died. And of course, Mazarin did put forward Louis's name as Holy Roman Emperor back in 1658, when Ferdinand III originally died. So this is possible, that now having we have the declaration of the declaration of the clergy of France, we have the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, and now we have this ultimate desire to become Holy Roman Emperor. But of course, no one is prepared to countenance this. We have the League of Augsburg, which consists of the Holy Roman Empire, Spain, Sweden, Saxony, and Bavaria. Sweden has now switched sides against France. And perhaps I would argue the most fatal incident to, you know, France becoming a global power, or a, you know, something equivalent where, you know, what Britain would become in the 19th century, is the Glorious Revolution. Of course, indirectly, the Edict of Fontainebleau spurs on the Glorious Revolution by sending English Protestants into this hysteria around their Catholic King James II. We have the letter of the Immortal Ten, which is sent over to the Netherlands to William of Orange, William III. He invades Britain. James II leaves, and he's declared to have forfeited his kingdom, and his son is essentially declared declared a bastard to justify the fact that William III is taking over the throne. And what this means is, up until now, James II and Charles II, the two kings of England, have been in the pro-French camp. Indeed, they have been prosecuting a war against the Netherlands. In fact, James had been the first Lord of the Admiralty in prosecuting the Royal Navy's campaign against the Dutch. But now we've already have this coalition against France, the League of Augsburg, been building up in 1686. But now the Dutch have created this major diplomatic realignment by William III taking over and establishing a new regime in England. So with the Glorious Revolution, we have ushered in a Grand Alliance and the War of the Grand Alliance, which involves the Netherlands, England, the Holy Roman Empire, Spain, Saxony, Bavaria, and Sweden, all against France. And you would think with a coalition like that, France was bound to lose, but the French actually do very well. And at the Treaty of Ryswick in 1697, the French have to concede many of the territories that were taken by France during the War of the Reunions. But by and large, all it's done is drain France's financial resources, and proven that the reforms, the absolutist reforms, the military reforms in France have been effective. What also needs to be considered is that in the previous conflicts at the beginning of the century, the Spanish and the English had, and the Dutch, had directly intervened in the internal matters of France. During, just before the war against Spain in 1635, Richelieu had attacked La Rochelle, not just because it was a Huguenot stronghold, but because it was a possible entry point for the English to attack the French. And of course, the Spanish, having been vehemently opposed to the Protestants in France and the Huguenots, now finding that there was no Catholic opposition to the House of Bourbon, which was, you know, vehemently Catholic, they begin adopting a completely cynical, you know, attitude of supporting Protestants against the erstwhile enemy, again, doing what the French are doing against them. So it seems rather fitting by supporting the Huguenots. So Cardinal Richelieu is able to establish French sovereignty. This is confirmed under Mazarin. And by 1697, France is a sovereign power. It is an effective military power. It is able to sustain itself against a coalition of essentially every major European power. Even Savoy enters the war at this point. But I'm going to leave it there in terms of the reign, the actual chronology of the reign of Louis XIV, because the next lecture discussion episode we're going to have is going to be on the Spanish War of Succession, which is so complicated in terms of the causes and the resulting diplomatic revolution that comes out of it, that I really need to dedicate an entire episode because it relates to German, French, Spanish, and Italian history, and British history indeed. So that war is going to, and the build up to that war and the implications of that war is going to get its own stream. So for this conversation, really, again, laying down the elements of French absolutism, we're going to end in 1697 before the War of Spanish Succession. So I want to turn here to aspects of or the limits of French absolutism. At first, Louis, with the assistance of Colbert, his general controller of finance, had been able to implement an efficient system of taxation and reduce national debt after the war with Spain in 1659. By 1667, the government was running a surplus. Colbert sponsored the development of manufactories such as silk manufactories and tapestry manufactories, while he encouraged Italian, Swedish, and Dutch artisans to come to France, ensuring that France would be able to increase its exports and limit its reliance on trade at a time of near constant wars. This, of course, is a system referred to as mercantilism, which France is going to export to Spain in the 18th century. This idea of the economy working towards the national interest against the ideas of free trade. The greatest project undertaken by Colbert, save of Versailles, was the construction of the Canal du Midi, and this is a canal linking the Bordeaux region through here to the Languedoc and coming out from the Atlantic into the Mediterranean. The canal epitomized this policy of economic nationalism and royal absolutism, circumventing naval access to the Mediterranean via Gibraltar, enabling easy access to trade and the economic development of the resource-rich Languedoc region, while the region itself was in the heart of Huguenot territory and had participated in the Fronde. The region would thus be reconciled to the central government in Paris. However, there were limits to French absolutism. The Parlement of Paris had failed to impose its will on the monarchy during the Fronde. And as a result of this, we see an ongoing struggle between Louis XIV and the Parlement over the course of his reign. The Parlement's ability to withhold their assent by formulating remonstrances against the king's edicts forced the king to react, sometimes resulting in repeated resistance by the Parlement. And there are multiple parliaments in France. And rather than establishing a single national legislature, Louis XIV continues to expand these parliaments, which again is a system going all the way back, this idea of one national parliament established by Philip the Fourth, with the Hundred Years' War and the expansion of territory, it is customary not to expand the purview of the original parliament, but to add a new parliament. Right, where was I? Right, sometimes resulting in repeated resistance by the parliament, which the king could only terminate in his favor by issuing a lettre de jouissance. And in case of continued resistance, appearing in person in Parliament to institute a l'élite de justice. What this essentially means, again, going back to what Henry III was compelled to do when the parliaments were almost always on the side of the Catholic League, the l'élite de justice is essentially an act by which the Parliament is there to register French royal edicts. It's not there to debate them, it's not there to legislate, it's simply there to register. In such a case, the Parliament's powers were suspended for the duration of the royal session. King Louis XIV moved to centralize royal authority in his own hands, imposing certain restrictions on the Parliament. In 1665, he ordered that l'élite de justice could be held without the king's presence, and in 1667, he limited the number of remonstrances to only one. In 1673, however, the Parliaments resisted the taxes needed to fund the Franco-Dutch War. The king imposed additional restrictions and stripped the parliaments of any influence upon new laws by ordaining that remonstrances could only be issued after registration of edicts. The general hostility between king and parliament accounts for why the Paris Parliament never became a national parliament. Louis explicitly rejected this policy of establishing new parliaments in the conquered territories. Without a national legislature, without calling the Estates General, the monarchy was forced to make compromises in the absence of a clear mechanism to ensure consensus between the king and the notables of the realm. France had now established both a system of administrative division, the généralité, and a system of intendance or intendant, but such were venal holdings acquired by purchase. The profit incentive to become an entendant ensured that various members of the wealthy bourgeoisie were exempt from taxation and could farm their respective provinces for income, meaning only a fraction of tax income went to the central government. The rest was eaten up by corruption. In order to subordinate the aristocracy to the monarchy, indeed to bring them back under the control as part of a centralized army, Versailles compromised in the absence of a system of redress by granting the nobility exemptions from taxation. As France was almost always at war, the tie hit the lower orders hardest. Only during the Spanish War of Succession did Louis impose a temporary tax on nobility before suspending it. With the restrictions and compromises on taxation, vast building projects, and endless wars, the monarchy was forced to supplement its income through borrowing. The absolute monarch was in fact restricted by law and the uncodified constitution of France, and dependent on a system of political patronage. And referring this again back to Bossuet, can he who judges others escape his own judgment, and he do that which he condemns? Hence the fine law of a Roman emperor. It is worth saying of the majesty of the prince to recognize oneself as a subject to laws. Moreover, the system at Versailles placed great strains on the king as the center of the aristocratic culture in France. Should the king falter in that role, the system would decline with him. So we're talking about this idea that the king has to play this theatrical role as le roi soleil. Whenever the king degenerates, as was the case with Louis XV, so the entire aristocratic court around him degenerates with him. Essentially, the king personally has to carry the entire shoulders of the French elite in order to prevent the system from entering into a decline. But, you know, despite the splendor and the grandeur of Versailles, all of this masks the fact that the king is kind of acting in contravention of the, you know, medieval French constitution, rather than acting through the ancient nobility. He's, if anything, emaciated the ancient nobility, and he's instead relying on a system of bourgeoisie administrators, kind of like that of Philip IV. So it is not necessarily a far more efficient way of bringing in, again, you know, trying to resolve the various sort of inefficiencies or, you know, centralizing efforts of feudalism, because you're simply replacing a landed hereditary power base in the form of nobles with an appanage or domain. Instead, you're replacing it with districts, which have often a corrupt official who has bought that that right to tax that possession. And he's doing so not because he's a servant of the king, but because he is wanting essentially to make a profit from it. The fact that people go into tax collection to make a profit should indicate that only a fraction of the tax income actually makes it to the king. So we mentioned this idea of courtesy. We mentioned this idea of lèse majesté. Well, of course, this ought, in a perfect system of absolutism, to extend to all members of the king's government as the king's representative. But obviously this wasn't always the case. And of course, the fact that the king had to essentially bypass the nobility, make these compromises when it came to issues such as taxation, or put them on the back burner. So, for example, borrowing vast amounts of money, and the fact that he was forced via the system to place a disproportionate level of tax burden on the poorest orders of France, of French society. All of this was almost a way of escaping the fact that the king was almost afraid to act through the nominal institutions of the realm to facilitate his rule, these being the Paris Parlement and the Estates General. It's interesting that under one of the most absolutist and centralizing of all the French kings, Philip IV, these institutions brought forth, but now they are seen as nothing more than a distraction or a hindrance to royal power. So it is in the absence of these systems, these systems functioning properly, i.e. to facilitate royal rule, as to why they've essentially been, they haven't been abolished, they've essentially lapsed. And of course, when the king does finally, after a 175 year period of the Estates General being in abeyance, called again, it has such a religious implications. So I'm trying to sort of emphasize, I mean, De Maistre talks about this as well, the idea that the king is often best when he makes his decisions not just with his council, but he also makes them through the consensus of the Estates of the Realm. The king is absolute. The king makes executive decisions, but such the authority of the king and the legitimacy of the king is compounded by the fact that he is working through these institutions. Instead, what the king is doing is bypassing many of these said institutions, and he's instead relying on the nobility adopting these roles as essentially, groupies of the king, surrounding him in order that they don't rebel, and adopting this rather servile, obsequious culture in Versailles. But at the same time, they are not fulfilling their proper function. They are not fulfilling that feudal function. And as a result, it becomes, I would say, far clearer in the minds of, when we get onto the intricacies and the failings of the what we call the Ancien Régime. But of course, the Ancien Régime is inherently progressive. It just means in French, the old regime. This is simply the French monarchy taking a turn. What we have seen here is a system of power which has been implemented to counteract the near century of French civil wars, beginning with the death of Henry II and culminating with the Fronde. And of course, earlier this had a major religious component with the rise of the Huguenots, who again were disproportionately represented in the lower nobility. So what we see is a major breakdown of the feudal political system in France, and French absolutism is some remedy to it, but it doesn't fundamentally change the system. Rather, it paints over fundamental aspects of the system. And if you have again, it all relies on the fact that the king is supposed to embody this idea of sanctity and perfection. So when it is easy to mock the king and, libel becomes commonplace and this idea of sanctity is removed, then it essentially becomes fatal, this notion of kingship. So yes, I hope that establishes a nice overview for you of the position of the French monarchy in the 17th century. I'll just look over to see if we've got any super chats, and then I'll be off. Unless there's going to be a flurry of interesting questions that people want me to answer before we go. Judge Caligula Bushman for 10 euros. Do you agree with Yale Prof. Merriman's conclusion that most of Europe turned to absolutism because of aristocratic social structures, except for the Anglo-Dutch mercantile societies, or is this too liberal? Yes, I believe it's too liberal. I mean, aristocratic social structures don't lead to absolutism unless they're breaking down. What I've described is a system which is meant to circumvent feudalism. It's not inherently feudalistic, it's inherently top-down. You have, you're replacing nobles who are supposed to perform a role of intermediaries of the king. You have the peasants who owe their lot to a lord, and that lord owes his lot to the king. Instead, the lord has been placated, and the king has circumvented the lord by appointing a middleman in the form of an intendant to govern that province, generalité, which don't correspond to the ancient sort of feudal domains of France. So, no, I think it's clear when we look at French absolutism that what Richelieu is doing is legitimately responding to what he sees as not only the breakdown of the French political system, which would have been the case under a weak king, and all of the horrors of the French Wars of Religion rearing their ugly head during his early reign, and combine that with the fact that France is now to occupy this position as the first nation of Europe. Richelieu is a master in terms of restoring the political situation in France and in eliminating foreign rivals to France. This is essentially what the Holy Roman Empire was not able to do. The Habsburg ruler was able to do it within the Habsburg domains themselves, but outside in the empire proper, the Treaty of Westphalia confirms this idea of the German liberty, i.e. the right of the Furst, or the princes of the empire, to have certain rights and to have essentially autonomy. What this is a system of bypassing those ancient rights. In terms of the reason why the Anglo-Dutch societies didn't go this way, I mean, as I discussed in my Dutch Revolt lecture, I mean, it was essentially a revolution what happened in the Netherlands, because you had a system of monarchy. The County of Holland had existed as a monarchy for the longest time. In fact, there was even a king of the Romans who came from Holland who would have been Holy Roman Emperor if it weren't for the very unstable situation of the empire in the 13th century. There were sort of democratic precedents, one could argue, or rather liberal precedents. I hate to use the word democratic in this context, given all its implications, with the Frisian freedom. But no, it was essentially, again, a system where there was anarchy, there was political disorder in the north, there was the absence of a recognized authority. They had overthrown a king, and the House of Orange never established themselves as an effective monarchy. So the mercantile system sort of arose as a byproduct of that. And of course, it also arose as a byproduct of the fact that Antwerp, which had been the former center of mercantile life in Europe up to that point, had been utterly destroyed by the war, and given the loss of access due to the permanent Dutch blockade thereafter, Amsterdam would become the main financial center. As for the English system is the opposite of this. What we see in England is, what we see in France is, an example of what would have happened had Charles I won the English Civil War, and not just won it, but won it decisively, in that Parliament, which was constantly warring over the king in terms of finance and foreign policy, would have been simply called less, and the king would have found extra means to finance his wars or whatever, even though England didn't really need that much taxes compared to France, because it did need a large standing army. But of course, that didn't happen. Parliament won the English Civil War, and the Roundheads won the Glorious Revolution. So what happened in England is the opposite of what we see in France, is that Parliament conquered the king. In the first instance, they got rid of the king. In the first instance, they imprisoned the king, essentially within a new system, one which William III was prepared to countenance, because William III was a... Essentially, he conquered England to effect a revolution in diplomacy to save Holland and form the Grand Alliance. So he didn't care about his own sort of domestic sort of supremacy in England. And also he inherited the Dutch system as well. So he was familiar with that. So what we see in England is the same thing. We see the breakdown of Parliament's relationship with the king. But in England, Parliament wins, whereas in France, the king wins. Of course, you know, revisionist historians will come back and say that, as you know, this is a point of, you know, English exceptionalism. But yes, I mean, like I said, I will always say that the monarchy, which is ushered in during the 18th century, is essentially impotent compared to the monarchy in France, which is still fundamentally executive, the rise of Robert Walpole and the Whigs in the 18th century. The king still performs an important constitutional function, but in terms of his executive authority to act, he very much delegates his authority. Whereas, as we see with Louis XIV, even though he rules through Mazarin during the beginning of his reign, he takes it upon himself to act as chief minister and head of state. He is both head of government and head of state, and this certainly can't be said for the English monarchs after the 18th century. Right. Okay, you're confirming. Merriman's theory claims that because of a strong bourgeoisie, absolutism didn't catch in Britain, Holland, unlike. But you're going to have to sort of elaborate that, because I don't obviously subscribe to the convenient system of feudalism versus capitalism. With France, mercantilism comes in to replace feudalism. Mercantilism is increased state control, increasing French government control over finances and directing the economy. You're going to have to elaborate, because what do they mean? They mean because of a strong aristocracy, therefore absolutism had to come in to contain it, or the strong aristocracy bred absolutism, because that's quite difficult. In terms of, you know, that means that's quite a big distinction. I'll just see if there are any other questions, then I'll get out of here, because that's it when it comes to super chats. Right. Oh, and chat, do refrain, please, from talking about current events. I know it's quite difficult at the moment, but please try and keep the chats on topic for future. So that's it. There aren't any other questions. In that case, the discussion component to this lecture will be on Monday. And I have another thing planned for tomorrow. I'm not quite sure how it's going to turn out, but Panama Hat and Sargon of Akkad are going to be coming on to discuss the political philosophies behind English liberalism and continental reactionary philosophy. So join us for that. I'm not sure how I'm going to work that into some sort of historiographical narrative. It could be interesting. Anyway, good night.